Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. There's a lot of important work being done at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. And on the show today, we'll tell you about some of the work with microbes. And our guest, a couple of guests for you. Tina Nielsen is the Associate Director of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Tina, good to see you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, and our first-time guest, Vatsan Raman, Assistant Professor of Biochemistry at the UW College of Ag and Life Sciences. Vatsan, great to have you with us as well.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what. We'll find out some more about his research, the work that he does in his lab, and how it all fits into this biofuel research. And I hope you'll join in with your questions as we move along today, or comments. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Tina, maybe just to start, give us a little bit of an overview here about some of the research and details relating to biofuel. Somebody even said, well, what is biofuel?
Great. Yep. So Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center is now 13 years old.
Yep.
And we've had an evolution that has occurred over those 13 years. So the first 10 years, we focused on particular bioenergy crops. They even included corn at that time.
Yeah.
And we were producing primarily ethanol. Well, the industry has been there, done that. We have a number of biorefineries out there that are up and running in Iowa particularly, but elsewhere, many in this state as well within
sure.
Wisconsin. But in 2017, we were funded again by the Department of Energy Office of Science, and we're challenged to get into a more complex set of research questions that really involved integrating the entire pipeline. And what I mean by that is looking at the plants that are growing in the field, and those plants could be switchgrass or something called sorghum, which expands the footprint of geographic region where you could have biofuel crops grown. They're quite drought tolerant. And we also have poplar trees that we're doing research on. Then you also have to break those down, deconstruct them. Vatsan's work involves that area. And then you convert them into a product. Well, what changed between the old center and the current center is that the products have expanded. It's not just fuels anymore. It's not ethanol. It's higher value fuels like isobutanol that you can put right into your gas tank, jet fuels, things like that, but also products that you would get from the barrel. So we want to replace the entire barrel. So you're looking at high value commodity products. One of our very exciting research activities that was highly publicized recently was green Tylenol, basically making acetaminophen from plant material. So we're looking at the entire scope of what you can get from plant material, and we're trying to basically recreate what the Earth does over millions of years in our time scale in days or months.
Pretty cool stuff. it really is. And Vatsan, your research plays into all this, of course.
It does. And really, if you sort of think about how biofuels are made, there are two major steps. One is the upstream step, which is how you take plant biomass and use one of many different methods to break it down into small parts, which are oftentimes sugars, and then how you can feed them to microbes. And microbes are really amazing in that they have their metabolism, which is how they can consume these sugars and make all kinds of amazing molecules. That's already built in by years and years of evolution. And so that the second half of the process is how can we convince and coax these microbes to really make the molecules and the products that we want them to make or the biofuels we want them to make. Now, it turns out microbes, just like all of us, want to multiply and be happy. And they have no interest in making these bioproducts and biofuels for us. But what we do is really understand how the microbe is wired together at the level of its DNA and figure out how can we tinker with the DNA of the microbe to convince it to make the bioproducts that we want. And so what my lab does is focus on the second half of the question, which is how can we modify these microbes to make biofuels and bioproducts? And oftentimes it's also challenging to know what modifications have to be made to get them to make a lot of biofuels and bioproducts. And so what we do in our lab is to design what are called as biosensors, and these can detect microbes that are making, say, large volumes of a certain product and would light up, and that's when we would know that this microbe has the right DNA modifications to make a biofuel. And then that goes through a further downstream process to scale up production.
Somebody was asking and wondering where the microbes come from. Are the microbes already within the plants, or are they something you bring in from outside the plants?
So there are a variety of microbes that can be used. There are the workhorse microbes like E. coli, and this is the non-pathogenic version. These are the lab E. coli strains, and yeast, which are oftentimes used in many, many microbiology experiments. But what the new bioenergy GLBRC center is focusing on now is to go after what are called as non-model microbes. And so these are microbes out in the wild which have really unique metabolic capacities. Just to give you one example, so one of the microorganisms that the GLBRC is focusing on is called Zymomonas mobilis. And what is different about Zymomonas mobilis is that it can make a ton of ethanol. And most bugs would die in that amount of ethanol, but Zymomonas mobilis swims and is super happy. But which means that it has the capacity to make a lot of ethanol. And what's even more remarkable about the strain is that it does not need pure sugar. You can give it sugar that has other mixtures and impurities and sometimes even toxins. And it's a pretty resilient strain that can use all these different kinds of feedstocks and convert it into valuable bioproducts. And so that's the focus of the new center. And so sort of the short answer to the question is there are the lab strains, but there are amazing strains out in the wild that could be potentially tamed to make biofuels.
Now, how do you find these strains in the wild?
So we have a researcher named Chris Hittinger, who is a yeast expert, a geneticist, and there are a lot of times where they go out on exploration missions where they go out into areas within nature, sometimes locally, sometimes globally, and they look for conditions that are degrading the materials out in the wild. Mm-hmm. So those are degraders within the microbes, so they're breaking down the plant material. He also has a great relationship with many other yeast specialists. But if you think about yeast, you might start thinking about bread and beer.
Yeah.
And so he has an amazing network with brewers in the region. And so they explore those types of strains of yeast in converting into products that are preferred.
Well, that'd be a good job to have.
Some of his yeast has been used by Wisconsin Brewing and created some very nice beers to sample.
So you mentioned the different kinds of products that you were working with. A different poplar was one, for example. So how does that work?
So the choice of what crop to grow depends on what you're trying to get from that crop. And so in general, the balance between a perennial and an annual crop is really important to understand when you're thinking about the agronomic economics of what the farmers want. We focus a lot on grasses, which is switchgrass, and corn is, mm-hmm. is a grass. So we've learned a lot from corn, and we've been able to apply it into the other systems. Switchgrass is a perennial. It's a great option for farmers. But some of them also want an annual, which sorghum is an annual, and that gives them flexibility within their fields. Poplar is exciting because it's very fast growing and it creates a lot of biomass. And there are many farmers that really like to create woody biomass. That's their expertise. And so that allows flexibility in those choices for the farmers.
Thinking about sorghum, my grandpa used to put sorghum on his pancakes That's all we ever had in the house.
Yep, high sugar content. You can understand why you'd want to get at it. We do use energy sorghum. It's quite different. One of the things in our mission is that we are not to be using food grade plant material. We do not want to get into the food versus fuel debate. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that we've gone even further on with the food versus fuel debate is we will not use extremely fertile land. We will not displace the crops that should be grown on that fertile land. So we go after lands that are called marginal or opportunity lands, where they're not necessarily productive for an agricultural setting, whether it's because of their slope or the nutrient content or the any other variety of reasons. So not only is it we're not going food versus fuel on the type of crop, but it's also the type of land. So we try to stay away from that argument.
And switchgrass does pretty well on marginal lands.
It does. Right?
It does.
It grows naturally throughout the whole upper Midwest, and so it's a great fit for our Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center.
Really cool. Well, we're talking today with Vatsan Raman, Assistant Professor of Biochemistry at UW-Madison, and Tina Nielsen, Associate Director of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Great to have them with us as we talk about what's going on at the center, and also taking a little more closer look at microbes and bioenergy with them today. Questions for them, I hope you'll join in. What do you have about the role of microbes in biofuel development? What would you like to know maybe about the future of biofuels? Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Nigel O'Shea, our engineer today. Natalie Guyette, our producer. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at what's going on with the in the department, in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center with our two guests for today, Tina Nielsen, Associate Director of the GLBRC, and Vatsan Raman, who is an assistant professor of biochemistry and heavily involved in the work there. You can join in with your own questions. Again, the number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. You know, thinking about the different kinds of plants and materials that you use, and your concept that you mentioned earlier, sort of maybe a little in passing, was use everything, use the whole of the plant. And I got to believe there are some parts of a poplar or other plants that would be more difficult to really use everything.
Yeah, so that's one of the main research topic areas that we have within the center. So the center is made up of 10 different research teams that are all organized under integrated concepts. And one of our teams is specializing in what's called lignin valorization. So let's put that into English for most mm-hmm. people. Lignin is one of the three components that makes up plants. There's cellulose, hemicellulose, and lignin. Lignin is a highly complex polymer. It's made up of ring structures that could end up being very valuable. But in the past, most people have said you can't get any value out of lignin unless you burn it and you basically generate the heat to run your plant. There's a company north of here called Beauregard Lignitech that has actually made a pretty good living out of making value out of lignin. But we're looking at it in a biofuels, bioproducts way. So that's about a third of the plant material that previously people weren't using. And I'll let Vatsan talk about some maybe lignin degrading enzymes in a second. But we also have something called the conversion residue valorization team. Valorization just means making value out mm-hmm. of that. And previously, when you got done with a fermentation, so you made your ethanol or your fuel, there was stuff left over.
Yeah,
it's called stillage or conversion residue. Well, there's still a lot of carbon in there. And there's a lot of microbes that will still eat that carbon and make really amazing products, novel fatty acids and other materials that are very high value. And so every gram of carbon we can get at and make a product out of, that's some of the research that, that we're looking into.
So I'll maybe take a step back and maybe put this in sort of a broader economic perspective, which is if you take a barrel of oil, right, 15%, 1/5, is used for making petrochemicals, right? And
yeah.
The remaining 85% is used for making regular fuels. Now, it turns out that the 15%, 1/5, contributes to 50%, 50, of the total revenue, right? And so which means there is an enormous opportunity here to not just make biofuels, which is obviously great, but also to take advantage of the bioproducts segment. And again, as I mentioned before, microbes are really amazing at making all kinds of bioproducts. Now, as Tina mentioned before, the lignin was historically sort of discarded or was just used as a fuel source, which is sort of cheap. But one of there is a team in GLBRC that is using a microbe called Novus fingobium. And what is amazing about, again, Novus fingobium against one of these non-model microbes
yeah.
is that it can use lignin and break it down into smaller molecules called aromatics. And I'll give you one example of a molecule which lignin can be used. Lignin can be used to make vanillin. And so vanillin extract is used in all kinds of cooking applications.
Sure.
And it turns out, therefore, that you can use the bark of a tree, get the lignin out of the tree, and convert that into vanillin. And instead of getting them from vanillin extract and beans, we can just have the microbe spit out vanillin and purify it and use it. And so that's sort of one example of an amazing application that we can use lignin for.
And I'm trying to remember how much I paid for the last little bottle of vanilla. That's a high value.
I just bought one for $15 last night.
Well, you know, if we have our way, you will have it for a dollar.
Well, you know, lots of people online with questions or comments, so we should take some calls here. Dan in Coloma, we'll go to you first. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Hey, I have a friend of mine that called me up, and he had these little these little black bugs that looked like pepper was sprinkled on the snow. So I looked it up, and it's a snow flea or a springtail. I don't know the scientific name for it, but they have like a little glycol or something they produce, so there's like antifreeze for them, so they're able to navigate through the snow. And they eat leaf litter and other, you know, natural things, to, you know, part of the biodegradable stuff, I guess. So anything like that in the biofuel industry?
So we have an investigator affiliated with the center. His name is Cameron Curry, and he's actually an expert on leaf cutter ants. And so if you know things about leaf cutter ants, they're very similar to the snow fleas that you're talking about, where they find that biological material and they break it down. And what Dr. Curry looks at is the enzyme composition that's within the gut of these leaf cutter ants and looks at those degrading chemicals. And that helps us within our deconstruction and enzyme improvement team. So we are looking
create
at stuff
those
like that.
In the lab.
Correct. And sequence them and figure out the composition and look to see how we can optimize that deconstruction portion within the center.
And, Watson, before we go back to the phone, part of your work involves sort of streamlining the whole process, does it not, of picking out which?
It does. The microbe, again, has no interest in making this for us, right? And so the question is, how do we modify the DNA of the microbe and get it to make more? And we know a lot about microbial genomics, if you will, but there's a lot that we still don't know. And so what we do in my lab is if we make many, many sort of smartly chosen modifications, but again, you have to make many, many of these,
yeah.
And this could be in tens of thousands, we want to ask the question, which one of these modifications to the microbe will make more biofuel? And so it's a process of winnowing these large number of modifications.
Yeah, that's a lot of winnowing if you've got
that's right. But we develop tools to identify which one makes more, and once we know that, then we can use that for scaling up and production of biofuels.
So you've got a process that does that more quickly than just going through 10,000 times.
Absolutely, and that would take years and years of effort. And what we can do in our lab is figure that out in a week or so.
Oh man. Dan, again, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Dave and Toma will go to you. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. I'm going to be the downer here, but, you know, the benefits of corn ethanol are already iffy at best. And now, in an hour, you're probably going to have a show on how to provide more habitat for nature. And now we're talking about using the marginal lands to grow more ethanol. You know, we criticize Brazil and them for burning down the rainforest, and it seems like in this country we don't do anything to stop growth of farms and cutting down what forests there are left. And I'll take her response to this off the air, but I'm against ethanol.
Dave, I thank you very much for calling. You raised some points I'm pretty sure our guests want to respond to. Tina? Those kinds of things are actually considered in the whole process, are they not, in the work you're doing?
Absolutely. So when we were formed 13 years ago, one of the biggest things that we put into the center, which was not part of the funding opportunity, was that we wanted to study the sustainability or the environmental impacts of any of the biofuel crops being grown on the land. And so one of our scientific directors, who's based out of Michigan State University, I haven't mentioned this yet, but we're in a major partnership with Michigan State University, and we're both land-grant universities, so we're very concerned about agronomic impacts, environmental impacts. We have done a tremendous amount of modeling and data collection with respect to what the impact would be. And so many of the findings that we've had with respect to having perennial crops, having polyculture, what that means is you don't want a single species on the landscape. So it's been shown that having acres and acres and acres of corn is very bad for biodiversity, whether it's bug biodiversity, pollinators, birds, any of the wildlife. So we would agree with you that ethanol is not the answer, and also monocultures or single species crops is not an answer. And so we are modeling that, and we would assert many of the reasons why you're against it. One of the things that you mentioned is that the returns are already marginal. We understand that. We do techno-economic analysis on the whole pipeline. And why it's really important to look at the whole pipeline is you want to understand the impact, but you're also understanding the products and the supply chain management. And so you want to optimize how far it is that you're transporting that fuel to a plant, and then what you're getting out of that plant. Well, we do have these corn ethanol plants, but we don't want to use the corn kernels that they're using in the corn ethanol plants. We want to help make it economically viable. So we would be proponents of what's called a bolt-on biorefinery, where you're next to where you're already getting that material shipped in, and you're enhancing the products that are coming out of that, and you're using different waste streams of those factories. So leveraging what you already have and trying to create more jobs out of the rural communities that are already not getting high margins off of the corn.
Yeah, good points. And Dave, thanks again. Bill in Stevens Point area has something that may relate to this. Let's go there. Hi, Bill.
Hi. At this point, can it be profitable to raise the sorghum or poplars or grass on marginal land? And how close are manufacturing facilities that would receive the products?
Yeah.
So within our modeling portion of our center, again, one of those 10 teams, we try to take all of that information and create the models of how much biomass you need to have on each acre in order to make it where it would be economically viable. And it gets complex quickly. So there's the amount of biomass, there's the distance you have to travel, there is the deconstruction method you have to use, which is typically the biggest bottleneck within the entire system. It's the most costly portion of it. And then what are ultimately the products and waste streams that you have? And so with the center, we have a number of people all through the value chain. We have the people who grow the crops, the sustainability experts that analyze the impact of that. We have techno-economic analysis people within their engineering department here. And then we have people looking at the deconstruction and conversion technologies to optimize that into something that could possibly be profitable. But at this point, none of them are standalone high profitability. And so it really needs to have a hard look at each step of it.
Maybe I can just add one more thing to that, which is there is really no one-size-fits-all solution to this. And what that means is the biorefinery has to be an integrated system where you have to have the option of being flexible with the feedstocks and flexible with the bioproducts. And this might change year to year. This might change season to season. And so the model going forward has to be one where, again, you can make diverse products based using different kinds of microbes and use different kinds of feedstocks. And so as Tina pointed out, there is a lot of techno-economic analysis that has to happen to make this an economically viable enterprise.
And, you know, we're kind of on the front end of things in a way. I mean, you've been at it, what did we say, 13 years?
13.
And so... I don't think there was ever any expectation that 3 years into the whole thing you were going to have a whole system. I mean, that's sort of the nature of research.
Correct.
It's testing as you go along and improving. And, you know, 10 years from now, it's going to look a lot different than it does today, you would hope.
I would definitely agree with that. I think that the change in our mission has signified that that is absolutely another iteration of where we're headed. And I think that bioproducts is becoming a bigger and bigger area of research because it's been realized, like Vatsan said, you don't get the high margin of return and you can't make the economics work with just having fuel come out of the biorefinery. And so I just want to give a quick plug for some events this week that if you want to hear more about these topics, Vatsan is actually sitting on a panel tomorrow that is called Biofuels and Bioproducts Replacing the Whole Barrel. And there's a great diversity of speakers on that panel, and it's going to be moderated by Troy Runge, who used to work for Kimberly-Clark. He's a pulp and paper specialist. And also, if you want to hear more about Novus Vignovium, which Vatsan mentioned earlier about the thing that can break down lignin into smaller chunks. Dan Nagira, who's the head of our lignin valorization team, has a seminar this evening at 4:30 in the Wisconsin Energy Institute. So both of those events are in the Wisconsin Energy Institute, 4:30 each evening. Tonight is the more specialized lignin valorization one. And tomorrow that Vatsan is on is about replacing the whole barrel. So a nice broad picture.
Yeah. And we should mention the website, the GLBRC and the Energy Institute websites, because there you can find out a lot about what's going on, including those events.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Bill, thanks again. Appreciate it very much. By the way, you can join in too. Question or comment, the number to call 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Mike in Madison next. Mike, hi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Appreciate the show. The focus on carbon that you mentioned, that's what the emphasis on this, and that's what's on my mind, is, you know, if you're going to be burning this stuff, you know, I know it's great that you'd be looking at other products, but if you're assuming that you're going to be using it, burning switchgrass and sorghum and poplar, then I'm interested in how do you compare the emissions versus carbon, including carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, versus gasoline or traditional jet fuel in a comparable vehicle? What the efficiencies would be, you know, in terms of how much CO2 or greenhouse gas is produced per mile of driven or whatever.
Yeah, well, good question, Mike. Thanks for calling.
So I'll take a broad stab at it. We are trying to not create ethanol anymore. We're trying to create equivalent to the gasoline that you're putting in your vehicle, or the equivalent to jet fuel that would go into a jet. And so the emissions are going to be quite similar. The only thing that we might have as a benefit of that is we won't have impurities because of typical refining procedures. There's normally just some impurities that remain. But we partner with the Engine Research Center here on campus to look at the combustion in the engines when we put our products in them. And we don't, our ultimate goal is to replicate the fuel that you currently use. We don't want you to have to buy a new car to put our product in it. The big benefit comes from us not taking carbon that has been buried or sequestered and using basically what you would call live carbon, carbon that's out on the ground right now, being able to go into the carbon cycle. And then we're not adding there's not a net increase in carbon dioxide or other materials that would come out of a petroleum barrel that you take that should be gone millions of years ago, buried under sediment, rock, et cetera.
Yeah.
And there's also a big push toward developing technologies where you can take the flue gas that comes out from industrial plants and actually put them back into microbes as a carbon source and have them convert that into a bioproduct. So essentially making a closed-loop system. And I think if we get to that point, and hopefully we're not too far away from there, you know, there could be a net carbon negative system in place.
Man, wouldn't that be great?
There's a great company in Skokie, and I'm blanking on the name.
LanzaTech.
And they're taking CO2 and converting it into products. So it's a very exciting field at this point.
What kind of products in general?
High value things like we're exploring, fuels and chemicals.
Oh, wonderful. Bob in Land O'Lakes, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how you doing? I just want to make a quick comment about your comment about making artificial or synthetic vanillin from this process. And the reason that vanilla is so expensive is because a lot of it, a great part of it, is sourced from very small producers in the Ecuadorian and Peruvian Amazon. And this is a non-timber forest product and is responsible for many remaining forests because they're able to generate an economic benefit through this vanillin cultivation or vanilla, natural vanilla. And my concern is just like with wild rice, what agribusiness with paddy grown rice did to that market and kind of destroyed it for the small producer. So I just,
it's a good point, Bob. Yeah,
there's unintended consequences that can come out of some of these products.
Yeah, that's a good and interesting point. Comment from our guests, Watson.
I mean, that is that's a great point. You know, oftentimes there's a supply and demand pull push, and what these new technologies can do is really sort of introduce a simple method to produce a large volume of a product that was previously hard to produce. And you're right, I mean, this might lead to a price drop. And we just have to be sort of cognizant of this.
I would push back a little bit on this, because if you look at your grocery store shelf, there's a major difference between the price of imitation vanilla and natural vanilla. And if you want to go to the Madagascar vanilla, oh, goodness. So People pay a premium when they understand the sourcing, but if you want to make a banana bread really quick and you just need vanilla and you don't care about the cost, you may go to something more on our realm. But if you really want that quality, I think you're still going to pay that premium for that natural grown vanilla.
Yeah. All right. There we go. Bob, thanks. Good points. Appreciate your call. Neil in the Milwaukee area. Hi, Neil.
Hi. Yeah, so I had a question about the energy and why no one ever researches electromagnetic energy, and they're constantly fixed on combustion burning fuels.
All right.
Well, you know, by electromagnetic energy, I'm guessing you mean sort of electrical sources.
Electromagnetic.
Do you have a specific example in mind?
That surrounds the planet, that energy.
We got a pause here, but as we're trying to think about.
It would be tough to harness within a transportation system, I think.
Yeah, I don't think we have a good answer for you on that one.
I will have to say the reason why we are looking at combustion burning fuel is because that is the predominant way that people transport themselves. And I will go back to our funding agency has put special requirements on us, and we are to look at biofuels and bioproducts that would replace the current products out there. The research that you might be suggesting needs to occur, that just wouldn't be the parts of research that would be within our center. But if we could harness more things that are extremely abundant, such as electromagnetic or solar, it's all positives. All forms of energy are good if you can find good uses for them. So not opposed to the concept, but we are mandated to do biofuels to replace current products made by petroleum.
And I haven't mentioned, I think in my introduction somewhere along the line, I mentioned crayons. Is there actually some work that relates to something as simple but useful as crayons?
You know, waxes. Crayons are made of waxes. So, you know, there is effort to make long carbon chain molecules. Now, whether they'll end up as crayons, I don't know. but certainly there is a lot of industrial application for waxes.
Oh, man. And again, for what's your website? What's the website for?
It's very simple. It's glbrc.org.
glbrc.org. Well, this has been interesting and a whole lot of fun. I assume we'll have a chance to do this again. Thank you both so much.
Hope so. Well, thank you, Larry. Larry.
Appreciate it very much. Vatsan Raman is an assistant professor in the Department of Biochemistry in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. Tina Nielsen is the associate director of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. She oversees external campus, government and industry relation, and internal administration as well. And I think there's another four or five things as part of her job.
Herding cats and all the other things.
there's a lot going on. But one of the interesting and fun things as we conclude here for me is the fact that we've got researchers from the broadest range of the campus who are involved in this. And I think that's one of the really cool parts about it, because we have a chance to look at it in so many different ways. I don't know if they're doing anything about the weather at the GLBRC, but I know some other guys, our weather guys, are doing some work in that area. So we'll talk with our weather guys about climate and weather next here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.